Welcome back to Trickle Down Socialism, where we discuss how the U.S. currently has a system of socialism for the super rich and corporations, where we try to defang the term socialism and explore how government, with just a slight tweak in priorities and a focus on social investment, could be a force for good in all of our lives.
Welcome back to Trickle Down Socialism. I'm Pat Donahue here with Dan Goldsberry and C Money Burns. Stick around for the interview. We talked to Awkward, a rapper and an abolitionist who's been working for years to try to end police oppression and police brutality and really reform the way that we do policing and prisons in this country.
Hey, happy Indigenous Peoples Day, guys.
I know Boston's making moves here, huh? I know you have a theory on this one, Dan, right?
October 6, 2021, a black mayor invokes Indigenous Peoples Day to the lament of 350 cities and towns that don't have it. Like, how fucking stereotypical can you possibly be? Finally, we can invoke Indigenous Peoples Day, except for the 350 towns that don't celebrate it.
Well, I especially love the Italian-American group stepping up and claiming that this is some type of Italian bias, anti-Italian hate that's coming out. And it's like, that's quite a stretch. C-Money, you had a few rejoinders for that one. How can we take that one apart?
I mean, my big zingers are that, you know, it's kind of a slippery slope. I mean, by that same context, you know, being anti-Mussolini is being anti-Italian, which I don't think anybody wants to go there.
You're anti-fascist, you're anti-Italian.
Yeah, and, you know, Italy wasn't even a country until the 20th century. It was a bunch of small kingdoms, and Spain underwrote the whole trip that Columbus took. So,
yeah.
It doesn't really make any sense, even though I'm sure the whole North End is in complete disarray over it. Don't they have a Columbus statue there or something?
Well, it didn't do too well.
And it went into the Atlantic.
Yeah.
Was that last summer?
Yes, it took a tumble.
Let's just say it's no longer al dente. it was a little, how do you say just right in Italian? I don't want to disparage the culture.
Yeah, the chef's kiss.
Well, let's just say it's more than a little salty now. It's taken on some characteristics of an aquatic lifestyle.
Well, meaning, I think.
I think here's my problem is that, like, we can rename the holiday. But it's like what we talked about with Mayor Bird that just feels performative, right? If we were actually giving land back to Indigenous people every Indigenous Peoples Day, or, you know, if we actually made some improvements, you know, material improvements in the lives of Indigenous people who are still alive in the United States, as some people seem to be in need of reminding, you know, way too often, then maybe I'd be really excited about it. But it feels like window dressing. And I really get behind Bernie Sanders and others when they say, let's just scrap it and make you know, election day a national holiday so that people
have a day off. It's one of those liberal isn't left sort of things. It's kind of like a performative liberal sop to cover it up. It's like a Band-Aid to put over Columbus Day rather than reckoning with it.
Well, Pat, as a history teacher, you would probably be aghast, but not surprised. I had a conversation with my advisory today, and I just put a picture of some Indigenous kids and Christopher Columbus. And I was like, what, why do we have Monday off? And they knew both angles, but they were like, I'm not sure why I have the day off. And I was like, well, we talked about the whole, what's the quote? Like, history is written by the winners, or like the, yeah, you know, like, why would a dude, I just found out this year in 2021 that Chris Columbus never came. He never actually came in North America. I knew he went to the West Indies, but like, what is the mythology of a dude who comes like sort of kind of near a continent and then gets a national holiday for it? Like, what's the, like, how does that play?
And then rapes and kidnaps and enslaves. I mean, they enslaved the inhabitants of those islands to make them search for gold. Like, and they took them, they kidnapped them and took them back to Europe to basically be like, look at these incredible, you know, alien creatures we found.
Well, and just to fast forward to bring it to the present, I've been following the great successes of the Cyber Ninjas in Arizona. I don't know if you guys have followed.
Too. Yeah, I watched that whole presentation.
Well, because I was always wondering, did Biden win by 10,000 or 14,000? And it appears that it was closer to 14,000. Did you know that there has been a proposal? It was either Arizona or New Mexico, where they put forward a rather benign idea of an election reform. And the reform was you must have a physical address, which on its surface is saying like, well, who wouldn't be for having an address? Well, guess who doesn't have an address with the United States Postal Service?
Homeless people?
Every indigenous person?
Yeah.
Because they all share the collective address of the reservation.
Right.
And I don't know that that Biden would have won Arizona without the indigenous vote. So I mean it can the shit continues in 2021. You know what I mean?
No, it's happening across so many states right now. It's really shameful and embarrassing and it's just going to cause a lot of trouble going forward if we can't pass some type of sweeping federal legislation that protects voting rights, which is just mind-boggling that we haven't been able to do that yet. But let's, speaking of schools, Dan, the TikTok challenge for September was vandalized bathrooms, which I have read happened across many bathrooms in the U.S. But are you surviving this October challenge? You know what it is for October?
Well, I'm on lunch duty pretty regularly, but I was standing out there talking to some kids in a soap dispenser flew out. And according to the students that I discussed it with, they said that it just fell out.
Yeah. Well, for,
you know, when you're pumping really hard, cause your hands are quite soiled and it just flies out the window. It does happen. It's happened. Well,
October is slap a teacher month on the TikTok channel. Ooh, so
have you been slapped?
I have not. I was hoping it would happen. Maybe, you know, I'd get TikTok famous.
I had seen that there was a response trend to the whole bathroom trashing thing. I forget what it was called, but I think the response was called Angelic Yield. I don't know if it caught on too much, but I did see some pictures, and it was people like leaving cash in a soap dispenser or leaving nice toiletries in the bathroom. That's, I guess, too bad that didn't catch on a little more.
Wow. So with this interview with Awkward, he's going to touch on a number of things. We talk about mutual aid, you know, depending on each other and building community and helping each other, you know, succeed and survive without using nonprofits and governmental organizations. But he also brings up the fact that we've heard, I don't know if either of you have heard of this crime wave, especially of homicides, that, you know, 2020 was just such a massive increase in crime, right? We've heard this trumpeted from a number of sources, right? Well, it's not borne out by the data, right? So most crimes are still down, and homicides had been down year after year. And if we compare it to the 1990s, last year was still far below what the 1990 homicide rates were. So I think it's really important to take a look at any report like that and kind of see, is this really based in fact, or is this fear mongering? You know, it feels to me like it's groups that are standing up and saying murders are way up are doing that as a way to respond and to build fear back up to prevent any type of reimagining of the police or quote unquote defunding the police. So I think, you know, Awkward mentions it a number of times that first of all, it's not even based in fact. But second of all, it's done really intentionally to try to build fear and prevent any type of reform or reimagining of the police.
It feels like Nixon, like late 60s, early 70s, like the playbook of like, they're coming. Remember when Trump tried that bullshit, like at the very end, because he doesn't have any attention span, like at the very end, he was like, well, the suburbs.
Yeah, how they were going to be taken over by low income urban dog whistle people because they were going to get rid of like single family zoning.
Because, you know, Pat, you know how in the suburbs of Boston, how the low income folks are like, let me buy up that 750,000 fixer upper.
Yeah, it happens you know, all the time.
They're like, let me grab that before some other, capital investor does so.
Yeah, and it actually, you know, it plays into, Rachel Rollins we've had on this show. She's DA for Suffolk County, and she's recently been nominated to be U.S. attorney by Biden for the state of Massachusetts.
It's getting held up, too,
by the way. Tom Cotton, you know, tried to hold it up and just basically pushed it back a couple of weeks. But she's able to point to the fact that not only are her policies of, you know, basically decriminalizing behaviors that arise from mental illness, from homelessness, from drug addiction, and seeking treatment or help for that person as opposed to jail time. Not only is that really working in terms of reducing our jail and prison population in Suffolk County and throughout Massachusetts, but our homicide rate is the only homicide rate of a major city in the US that didn't see any type of uptick in 2020. So, and not only that, crime rates across the city are way down. So she can point to not only the fact that she's actually helping people through her policies and she's, you know, doing something about the enormous, you know, mass incarceration problem we have across the entire country, but there are results that she can point to and say, like, look, when these people don't touch the system, they don't end up reoffending. So they don't end up leading a life of, quote unquote, life of crime, right? So I'm looking forward to the hearing where, you know, Republicans try to press her. I think Tom Cotton called her a pro-criminal activist, you know, where she can come back with the facts and say, like, you know, look, we're not only reducing our prison population, we're helping people, but we're also seeing results in terms of the crime rates in Boston.
Yeah, well, this is where like these short-term facts, from across the entire country flattened out, failed to tell the story of like the individual municipalities that have instituted things like bail reform, ending cash bail, those sorts of things. Like it makes it so no one has to address that stuff because we're talking about a national trend that was 12 months in the making.
Right. So Awkward is also going to talk about something called the 10 demands for justice. And basically these are 10 demands that build towards and work towards abolition of our carceral system and the police as we know them. It's really pretty comprehensive and, you know, it's all with an eye towards like, how do we help people and make people trust the system and work together as opposed to, you know, using the police, to solve all of our problems. Right. So like, for instance, the first demand, is just defund the police, but basically reallocate those resources to the impacted community. So in other words, instead of putting all of our money, you see many of these cities have more than half of their city budget is going towards the police. Let's put those dollars into programs that reduce homelessness or reduce addiction rates or reduce, bring treatment for mental health. But it has steps like demilitarizing the police, all kinds of stuff. It's a really comprehensive program. So I do encourage listeners to check out, if you just Google 10 demands or 10 demands for justice, you can take a look at all of the demands this group has, and then all of the actions that this group is taking to try. Basically, it's a response to, you know, Black Lives Matter, George Floyd, but it's really reimagining police and reimagining our system in a way that really benefits everybody and doesn't rely so heavily on punishment and enforcement, law enforcement to solve.
So where do you guys fall on reform in regards to like federal versus local? Because I know that Tim Scott from South Carolina was spearheading an effort for the supposedly spearheading. I don't know that it was an authentic effort on his part, or if he's the lone Black senator, right, of the Republican caucus. The George Floyd Justice and Policing Act failed miserably, I would say, in late September, but in the summer was really touted as, hey, you have Cory Booker and Tim Scott, two black dudes, right, hashing it out. This is a good thing. But like, how authentic was that? Like, how realistic was that?
Well, my problem is the limits that you know, from the federal level, you really can't change that much about individual, you know, police departments. So what I think needs to happen is you need to have areas like Minneapolis or Boston for that instance, you know, so cities that really take apart their police budgets and reimagine what they can do with that money, find creative ways. Like, for instance, Boston sending out social workers to calls where it involves some type of mental health crisis. That's who should be going to those calls, right? So let's let that happen for a while, and then we can point to that data. You are going to have holdouts. You're going to have cities that really refuse to do this. But the good news is that even in red states, often the cities are, you know, majority left, right? Majority left leaning. And so you can have cities that are in a red state where maybe the state legislature isn't even in favor of these types of changes, but they can take a look at a city like Boston or a city like Minneapolis and say, look, what they're doing there is actually having success and having a positive impact on people's lives. And so, unfortunately, that's the way it's going to have to go down. As much as I'm in favor of transformative change as opposed to reform, we're going to need to see some cities really take this on and be creative and reimagine what police can look like. And then we're going to need to be able, you know, we're going to need
totally.
To make so that C-Money, clear to other cities.
C-Money, I was thinking of you because I was reading about Minneapolis and they have they're putting something on the ballot in November and I'm reading just a quick quote. Department of Public Safety, shall the Minneapolis City Charter be amended to remove the police department and replace it with a Department of Public Safety that employs a comprehensive public health approach to the delivery of functions by the Department of Public Safety, with those specific functions to be determined by the mayor and the city council, blah, blah, blah. But that reminds me of Strimling, right? That was the guy in Portland, Maine, who was saying effectively, because look, if I'm not, I don't follow Minneapolis city politics, but my understanding is they were whole hog in for reform. And now it's a little bit later and maybe they don't know how they feel. So they're putting it to the people because there's not a political will to just do a straight up vote. But Portland does have a history of sort of like putting it out there to the folks.
Yeah. You know, there has been some stuff that's actually been coming to fruition this week from that. You know, right after we talked with Ethan, we had the city charter council elections in Portland, and DSA and left candidates swept that, which was kind of what we were hoping for. That was sort of the dream. And so one of the results of that is the unelected city manager felt a lot of pressure from them. He has since announced his retirement, which, you know, was something a lot of people were seeking before the city charter review even came out. But we just had our first meeting between the city charter council and the city council and the police to discuss the police reform specifically. That just happened a couple of days ago. And there's an article in the Portland Press Herald about that. If anybody wants to look it up, it's really interesting to see how far direct democracy has taken criminal justice reform in a really little city in such a short time.
That's great.
I just feel like as someone who's an observer but has never been to Minneapolis, this dude Jacob Frey seems like not at all the dude, because people are looking understandably to Minneapolis, not just George Floyd, but remember Philando Castillo was from there. And nothing happened. Like, did anything ever happen with that dude? Like, not even like a firing, like not even like a slap.
No.
On the wrist, like nothing.
I don't think anything happened.
And that's one you'd expect if they weren't so blatantly racist for the NRA to step in and say, wait, he had a legally registered firearm and he was going to show his firearm license and you just shot him up in his car. But
well, and if you watch the dude after the shooting, like Jacob Fry was like, did something happen? Like he looked really scared and awkward. No pun intended. Like he was not ready for that. And if I can, I have a quick quote from him or from the article about the about this ballot question. And it says Fry, who is running for a second term as mayor, opposes the ballot measure. And in his view, the provision that would place the power of reform or abolishment in the police in the hands of the city council is problematic. And I quote, when everybody is in charge, nobody is in charge, Fry said in an interview. I think that would dramatically diminish accountability. It would reduce clarity of command, whatever the fuck clarity of command means. But then he went on to say, I express support for aspects of the amendment that allows social workers, blah, blah, blah. So he's like equivocating, like, so cops can kill people or they can't, like, it are they accountable or are they not accountable? This guy's got to go.
In looking at the figures for Portland and our Police Accountability Review Board, I found that of 18,000 police departments nationwide, there are only about 200 citizen oversight boards across the whole country, and no two are identical. So it's really an idea that's kind of just getting off the ground.
Yeah, Rollins mentioned the fact that she set one up, and mentioned the importance of having non-police on that board, and it's just, it's shocking that you don't have that off, throughout the country, as you mentioned, and the fact that they all look different, that is also shocking.
Can we jump ahead of where we're at federally? Do you think that a federal... like George Floyd Justice Policing died, so they're going to have to rename it. But do you all think there's an appetite for something at the federal level that reforms, for example, qualified immunity or some sort of independent review board? Because clearly the Deep South and in the Bible Belt is not going to get on board, right, with any sort of substantive reform. So is there something, because I'm sorry, Tim Scott from the Deep South, who has admitted on camera his own, negative experiences with police, that's just not the right dude for the job because they're tokenizing him. Like he's not really going to do it.
I think the problem is that at the federal level, anything that passes isn't going to have enough teeth. It's not going to do enough to actually create real change in communities. So that's where I think it needs to happen city by city. And then we need to be able to really trumpet the success that's happened because of the changes made in X city or Y city.
I think the only way you'd see any sort of federal help with that is through funding or denying funding based upon memos. You know, with municipal control of police departments and the supremacy clause, I think you'd be hard pressed to have any sort of federal law that doesn't get challenged immediately and shot down. But that said, there was just a case in Maine against the Maine State Police for negligence that the Supreme Court just denied review. So essentially shot their qualified immunity case. And it's like one of the first times this has happened in the country.
So what you'll hear in the awkward interview is that this guy really, really knows his stuff. He's got some great solutions in mind, got some great ideas on how we can change the way that policing is handled in cities across the country. I think one other thing that you might not be able to see in the podcast version of this, that we'll try to remedy it by putting it up on YouTube for you in video format, is that for some reason or another, Awkward had about 30 cats, a couple of them adults, mostly kittens, in the room with him during this interview. And he had a filter on for his video feed, which put his background behind him. But every, I don't know, let's say 30 seconds, a new kitten would show up on his shoulder, like digging his claws into Awkward's shoulder. And he managed to maintain composure, answer these questions very eloquently, and really like dig deeply into these concepts of police reform and abolition.
It sounds like he loves freedom.
Sure.
You know, I mean, he's a patriot.
I was able to pull out the more egregious cat in heat part, but yeah,
the cat in heat was a little too much.
Yeah, that kind of blew my mind.
And upcoming, our next episode, we will have Dan Wilson, who is a trans vet veteran. He was in the Navy, and he's running for Congress to represent Ventura County in U.S. Congress. He has some pretty amazing ideas. And really also has a great grasp of the issues. And we'll talk about ideas like postal banking and some other concepts that Dan is really working hard on. Dan is also running as a nonpartisan. He's running as an independent because he is disillusioned with the Democratic Party and what they've done to certain candidates that he's been tracking over the years. And we delve into that. We talk about, you know, why he's choosing to do that and what he sees as kind of the nonpartisan revolution that he's trying to spearhead and organize.
Well, and just a quick thing on the postal banking services. There was just an article that came out the other day, and this kind of touches on Awkward's 10 demands. You know, they a lot of the demands on the list, which we should link in the show notes, talk about the systematic effects of the racial wealth gap. And, you know, Dan talked about that in the interview. That was a really good part of that interview. I'm excited to put that up. But I believe our last guest, William Compton, mentioned that as well.
Yep.
It seems like it's a common theme with some younger politicians. But, you know, in partnership with the Postal Workers Union, select post offices on the East Coast are testing doing basic banking for underbanked communities, mostly communities of color who have barriers to bank access due to low balances or bad credit or even just physical proximity. And they have to rely on predatory high fee / interest payday loan companies right now.
Or even check cashing. The check cashing, you know, business is atrocious in terms of how much money they take from folks just to cash their paycheck.
These select post offices are now cashing paychecks for $500 or less, putting them on Visa gift cards with no fee, but they're looking to expand if the program works. And it has the prospect of turning around the Postal Service's Republican-engineered insolvency and Postmaster DeJoy's draconian service cuts, as well as shrinking the racial wealth gap. So that's some exciting developments.
Yeah. And so I'm excited for our listeners to hear this interview with Awkward also, because a number of our guests have even said this, but I hear it all the time, people saying no one is in favor of complete abolition of the police. And I kept, you know, thinking to myself, well, I'm going to get this guy on and we're going to talk about what abolition would look like. And so I do want listeners to go into this interview with an open mind and just think about, like, let's be creative about this. And where could we end up? What would that look like? What would the experience be like for ordinary citizens? And, you know, how can we get past this idea that without police, it's just complete bedlam, right? Right. Like, how can
I like how you pointed out, Pat, you know, as someone who had a very whitewashed history, like I took AP US history, AP European history, but I never once heard about the Black Codes. Like I never once heard about the systems that were used to normalize and sort of codify the post Civil War laws, right? So I just assumed that laws were just. I was raised like that, hey, you know, there's a law. So the reason that we have a law is so that people obey the law, right? So being black after being enslaved for 200 years and not having a job is now a crime. That's sort of a weird law. That's something we should discuss because that's a kind of a fucked up law. Right, that's not something that was ever introduced to me as a white kid with white educators. It's just not even an entry point until I had to self-educate on those sort of things. Even in college, it wasn't a thing.
Right. And the police in the South were born of slave catchers. The slave catchers then became the police. And the 13th Amendment loophole is that, you know, slavery is now effectively ended, except in the case of incarcerated individuals. So they immediately jumped on that. And as you said, created laws like vagrancy laws that just made it illegal to be out and about and not employed in that moment. Which would then allow them to be arrested and enslaved again. Right. So stick around for this interview with Awkward. We'll get into these issues and more. Guest on this episode is rapper, journalist, organizer, and co-founder of the 10 Demands Awkward. Welcome to Trickle Down Socialism. It's great to have you on the show.
Thank you. Appreciate your time.
First, could you give our listeners a sense of who you are, what you stand for, and how you've been working to achieve those goals?
Yeah. You know, my biggest thing is justice. From the earliest I can remember to today, that's just been my focus. It's played out in a variety of different ways and with various focus points. But, you know, we live in a society that is, you know, unequal and unjust, where 1% of the population lives in lavish luxury and the other 99% struggle to feed their families, keep a roof over their head, and things like that. And then when you bring in race and, you know, and ethnicity and religion and sexuality and gender and all of these things, there are additional layers of oppression that people face that make poverty even more complicated. So my primary focus is the poor people's movement and racial and social justice. So as an abolitionist, the work that I do as a co-founder of 10 Demands, as well as through my music and my mutual aid organizing, is all for the purpose of creating new mechanisms that can enable us to keep ourselves safe, to provide for those in need, and to create an alternative society where we're not relying on the government and corporations, and our only response to you know, issues in society is cops in cages, but actually you know, doing things that address the underlying issue and prevent crime by truly making us safer, as opposed to relying on a white supremacist institution whose, you know, focus is protecting property and the rich from everybody else.
Yeah, and protecting class lines. So I do want to define two things for our listeners. The first is mutual aid. And many of our listeners probably know what it is, but I'd like to define that, and then abolition, exactly what you mean by that. So mutual aid, just explain to our listeners what it is, what you do with that.
Yeah, mutual aid is not philanthropy. It is not charity. It falls outside of the nonprofit industrial complex. It can be, you know, put in place by a random group of people in a community that come together because they see a need. There are established mutual aid organizations that are connected to charities so that they can receive funding. There are other organizations that are, you know, completely autonomous and collect from within the community. There's church groups that do it. There are leftist organizing, you know, coalitions that do it, but it's really non-denominational. It is apolitical. You know, it is basically, again, people taking care of themselves. So it is all done at the local community level. So instead of relying on the government or a massive nonprofit to, you know, give aid and then disappear, which oftentimes has an adverse effect, this is people in a community connecting with others in their community, identifying what the problems and the needs are, and then coordinating to provide solutions. So that can be anything from education and jobs training to free healthcare, to substance abuse treatment, to actual monetary donations to help someone cover the rent, to providing food, to providing shelter, temporary or permanent. Really, the opportunities are endless. And there are groups all over the country doing this. Most likely there is one in your area. You just may not know about it. So one of the things I'm working on doing is helping to expand and better promote something called Mutual Aid Hub that is basically an online community that connects mutual aid groups together and connects people in need with mutual aid groups in their area. So the mutual aid groups themselves use Mutual Aid Hub to share resources as well as best practices. Individuals and communities can go on to the Mutual Aid Hub website and find a mutual aid organization near them.
That's huge. And the second part, that's a really great explanation of mutual aid. And I think it's also opening up pathways that can, you know, like you say, last a long time for that aid to happen, as opposed to, like you say, programs that come and go or where eligibility ends for a person, for instance, with welfare recipients. Right. Abolition. So abolition of what? Abolition of jails, abolition of police, both?
Abolition is more an ongoing practice of liberatory praxis. It is fighting colonialism. It is fighting white supremacy. It is what I touched on earlier, identifying alternative mechanisms to both prevent crime by addressing underlying issues and respond to crime in a way that makes people truly responsible for their actions. And they owe a human debt to those they've committed a crime against. So where both the victim and the perpetrator, who's probably been a victim themselves, are able to transform in the reparative justice process. So abolition is, you know, it is not a tagline. It is not an end goal. It's a way of thinking and it's a way of being. And it includes the end of police and prisons. So that's typically all that people identify it with, is those, that last part. And there's also the misunderstanding and fear that it means lawlessness or that it would happen overnight and then it just ends and we just don't have police and prisons. But in reality, it's something that happens over time. So there are reforms like recommended or demanded by the 10 Demands for Justice that actually chip away at the carceral state. So there is a difference between reforms that set the road toward abolition and reformism, which is designed explicitly to uphold the system itself and just change it a little bit. We have decades of research and data demonstrating that reforms like, for instance, electronic monitoring only expand the carceral and surveillance state. We have tons of experience and, witnessing what an increase in policing has done. Cops kill three people a day historically. In 2020, they killed six people a day. They're responsible for a third of all stranger murders. And the people saying we have a crime wave, how can the answer be more police? If we have a crime wave with all these police, then the answer is something else, because what we're doing isn't working. So it is not replacing cops with nothing. It's not replacing prison with nothing. It's changing everything we've been taught since birth. It's not looking at it as simply crime and punishment, criminal and victim. It's looking at who is criminalized and why, and how they are targeted, how they are disproportionately arrested, sentenced, and incarcerated. And in place of police having and patrols having wellness checks and peacekeepers and social workers and, heavily trained medical experts handle mental health crises, removing police on the road to full abolition from so many of the things they shouldn't be doing, like monitoring protests, doing, pulling people over for taillights and things that lead to brutality and murder. And instead of putting someone in a cage and then letting them out onto society in a position worse than they already were, where they've lost their connections to their community, they've lost their job, they've lost their home, they've lost all these years where they're not getting job training and education, and now they also have a record with very few or weak reentry services. We want to provide a different form of justice where people are truly held responsible through mediation and community service. And those who are really not capable of transformation because of mental health issues, they get treatment. Abolition doesn't mean there can't be a place where someone who needs to be away from society can go. They just wouldn't be carceral in nature. The mental health institutions that were done away with, decades ago, which helped spur the homelessness crisis, those were essentially prisons for people with mental health issues. So in an abolitionist society, we would have treatment as opposed to punishment.
Right. Right. I love that answer in so many ways. The explanation of it as a mindset, as a process. And, all the details there that you provided, I'm really impressed with that answer. And also just that is the work that needs to be done. So on the issue of reforms versus reformism, I did have Suffolk County DA Rachel Rollins, who's recently been nominated for U.S. attorney for the state of Massachusetts, who has made enormous moves to decriminalize a large number of misdemeanors. Anything that comes out of homelessness, addiction, mental health, her inclination now in her entire office's inclination is treatment over prosecution and putting people in prisons, which is just, a big part of the battle is keeping people out of prison that first time, right? Because we know the recidivism rate. So I know that you're focused on a larger goal and providing so much more support, but why do you see abolition as the best outcome of the movement?
Well, I think that, reforms have shown that they're not effective. And that's because they're not intended to be. We call it a gentler form of genocide. When you give someone, just for instance, when you put someone on electric monitoring and probation instead of sending them to prison, they're essentially in prison in their homes. They are monitored all the time. They can't leave. It's very difficult to get steady work. They're not a part of their family structures or their communities. They can't go out and engage in things that their families and friends are doing. And we found that a huge proportion of the people being put on electric monitoring, if it didn't exist, which was a reform created to shrink the prisons, these people wouldn't have been incarcerated. They would have been let go. So we're now seeing more people put into the system, and it is so easy to violate your probation that at the end of the day, it's actually increasing the prison population.
Right. So you're putting people in their home environment where all the temptations are around them, but except with these new constraints in place, and any violation of those constraints sends you right to prison.
Right. Exactly. And there's so many examples of this. Body cams are another reform that was touted on both sides of the aisle. But what many people don't know is that police unions were the biggest proponents of body cams. People think, why would that be if they're afraid to be caught doing the things that they do? Well, for one, they control the video. They turn it on, they turn it off, and the video is facing outwardly. It's not showing what they're doing. It's not showing the hand motions they're making. It's not showing what's happening behind them. It's showing the person that they are going after. Mm-hmm. And so what this actually, body cams actually do is increase the surveillance state, just like electronic monitoring. Cops now have, in addition to the cameras on the streets, in addition to their dash cams, they now have this 360 body cam view that they can use to further monitor the criminalized populations they're already targeting. And at the end of the day, all of this is just a way to kind of appease people like me who are calling for stronger measures. They say, well, we agree there's a problem. You're crazy. We're not going to do what you want to do. That's absurd. Like, this is there. It's just this assumption that the way we've been doing it is not man-made. It's not a human creation. It didn't happen post-slavery, with the black codes, and that it was always there, and it's the only way it can be. It was literally created to, like, policing and incarceration were created post-slavery to maintain the profit system that the South had off the backs of black people. They literally changed laws. They created new felonies. They created black codes. They created chain gangs. And this just has continued today into the new Jim Crow, where, you know, certain populations are heavily policed, are brutalized by police, are afraid to leave their homes. Their families and communities are destroyed. They're sent to prison. And then they work for 0 to 8 cents an hour, providing massive profits to corporations. And that happens also at state and federal prisons, at local jails, at ICE detention centers, not just the 13% or whatever it is that is private. All of these public institutions of carceral punishment also have huge contracts with corporations, whether it's intentionally, coordinating with phone companies so that they reduce the amount of in-person visits, so they can jack up the prices for phone calls, or it's the money that is made off of commissary or the food or the clothing or, you know, the sheets, everything there is a profit. And so the only way to change something that's working exactly as it's intended to is, you know, which is to remove the other and profit off of them, is to come up with something else. Changing it a little just keeps it there. And typically these small changes actually further entrench us. When you look at Joe Biden's proposal to get rid of private prisons at the federal level, while many people celebrated that, in addition to it being such a small percentage, in addition to profit being a huge motivation for public institutions, there's also the fact that when he says that, knowing that all of the people in private prisons will not be getting released, but will be put into public prisons, he's actually just reiterating the understanding that prison is the solution. What isn't the solution, according to this suggestion, is a private version of it. It just reiterates the fact that there's no conversation about whether prisons are doing what we want them to do in the first place.
Right. No, and the history you touched on is so important. I'm almost done with my master's in history, and I teach history in Boston Public Schools. And just the idea that the police came about as slave catchers in the South, right? So their entire premise was to go after runaway slaves. And they had to be armed. That's why we have the Second Amendment. That's fine. But your point about that what happened in the Jim Crow era, I think is lost on some Americans, right? The idea that laws were changed to make it, for instance, illegal for a black man to be in a town, just to be, without a job at any moment, like if to be out and about without working was illegal. They could be arrested, thrown in prison, and then that labor was sold to people who used to own slaves and to fill that need. And it just needs to be known that that is how our system was created in the first place.
And loitering is another great example. That was a law created post-slavery too. Clearly not every slave immediately had a job when slavery ended. So they could arrest them, as you said, like for being, you know, if you were hanging out next to a building, that's now illegal. That was never illegal before. But when they realized that they could capture more Black people doing that, that's what they did.
Right. And so I do want to get into the 10 demands a bit. So you've kind of given me the philosophy behind it, I think. Could you point to specific demands within the 10 demands and where our listeners can find it to learn more?
Sure. 10 demands is an organization not tied to any nonprofit. It's a loose collective of individuals that got together in early 2020 to put together a list of demands that would get us to the alternative society that we envision, where poverty and race are decriminalized and communities are responsible for their own safety with support from independent institutions and local and state government, where you know, we are no longer using police and prisons. And, you know, the demands include a number of reforms that chip away at the system. So getting rid of cash bail, for instance, getting rid of qualified immunity that allows cops to essentially get away with everything they do, getting rid of prosecutorial immunity, abolishing ICE, instituting third-party kind of reviews of police and court procedures. There are a number of different things that can happen overnight, and a number of things that will take longer to happen. It's not necessarily in chronological order, but intellectually, theoretically, and honestly, in practice. It begins with defunding the police. We consider that step one. So again, this is not something that happens overnight. In 2020, there were about, 20 or so cities that began to defund, and, $100+ million was taken from police budgets and reallocated to programs designed to address the underlying issues. That needs to continue. It needs to each year be a larger percentage of the budget that is defunded, and eventually we defund to zero. But as we're doing this, we're allocating new resources to alternatives to incarceration and to preventative measures, to improving the living conditions of, our most heavily impacted communities. To the point where, at the end, there is no more carceral punishment. But this is the kind of thing that takes a lot of effort. It takes imagination. It takes, a ton of education and persuasion, because all of us have been taught since birth that, this is what we do with criminals, and that's them, and we're us, even though the percentage of those who commit crimes is far greater than the percent of those deemed criminal. So one of the biggest things that we at 10 Demands are doing is, an education program where we are, we have a huge resource database where people can learn more about what defunding means, what abolition means, why reforms don't work, the history of policing and incarceration, and in addition to that, we have a video series. We've done three so far where the members of 10 Demands break down in detail each of the specific demands, and there's 10. So we have, 4 through 10 still to go. And then the last thing is an opportunity for people to take action. There are so many things that people can do in their communities. And when I'm in my journalism role, I'm in your seat, and I'm interviewing fellow abolitionists, I always ask that question, what can people do? Mutual aid is a great example, as is something as simple as doing cop watching, videotaping the police, doing court watching, being an observer and seeing, you know, and reporting to the community on who is appearing and what the different sentences, the different charges, and things like that. You know, so there's a lot of opportunities, but one thing that anyone can do who may not have the time or the ability to do mutual aid, to, you know, to follow the cops or to go to the courts or even to go to a protest, we've created an open letter that you can send to your state or federal congresspeople, your governor, and your mayor, just using your phone. You can send a text that informs them of, you know, what problems we're facing and what their constituents are looking for. And it's not more reforms to pacify us, but true fundamental change. And it, you know, it essentially says, if you don't listen to us, you won't be reelected. And I think that, you know, in the mainstream media, there's a lot of copaganda going on about a crime wave that isn't real. There's copaganda about what defund means and that saying defund is a death sentence for your political career. Nina Turner never once said she wanted to defund police. In fact, she has a lot of police in her family and refused to answer questions about it. She lost anyway. I promise you that the system is what is causing Democrats to lose, what's causing leftists to lose. It is a lot bigger than simply a phrase like defund the police. It is the massive amounts of money that goes to more centrist and moderate Democrats who are in primary races with those on the left. That's your issue. And defunding the police is a solution that will actually keep us safer, which police don't do. That's something that people need to look at. In New York City, the police went on strike. Crime went way down. Recently, there was a new report of a pilot program in New York City where instead of sending police to mental health crises, they sent social workers. Violence, incarceration, decreased dramatically. No one was getting hurt. No one was getting arrested. No one was killed. They weren't using hospitals and ambulances. So those were freed up for real issues that they're needed for. And meanwhile, unlike when cops come and everyone is terrified and people refuse assistance, a significant amount of more people were calling for help and accepting help when it came, because it was not someone with a gun screaming at them and threatening them. It was someone who was trained to actually address the issue. And a big misunderstanding, which 10 Demands is trying to address, is we don't have a serial killer problem. We don't have a stranger danger problem. Most of the people who are sexually abused, most of the people who are killed or sexually abused by people they know. Cops are not stopping those crimes, and they're not even solving them. Cops solve 2% of all major crimes. And, you know, if anyone else did their job correctly 2% of the time, they would be fired. But cops are promoted and get hundreds of thousands of dollars to do this. And those who are fired, we've learned from the wandering cop phenomenon, they just get a job somewhere else. So, you know, what cops are really doing is dealing with petty crimes after the fact and further criminalized communities. So most crimes that are committed are low-level offenses. They're typically nonviolent, but the ones that are violent are typically the result of desperation and poverty. In my new song, Why We March, I talk about it in reference to Medicare for All. A father has a daughter. He goes and robs a pharmacy because he has no health insurance and his daughter's going to die. He is now a criminal. He committed a crime, but he did it out of desperation. If we had free healthcare, if we had mutual aid in his area that could get him the money he needed or the medication he needed, that wouldn't have been necessary. Drug addiction, mental illness, other huge causes of crime. If you're an addict and you don't have a job, your only way to feed your habit is to commit a crime. If you're mentally ill, you're going to behave in ways when you're having a crisis that you wouldn't want to behave in, and you're not able to control yourself. So being confronted with someone who's screaming at you and giving you confusing, contradictory commands is the last thing you're going to respond to. Anyone who's ever been in a mental health crisis or knows someone who has knows that. It's logic. So 10 demands is the alternative to what we have today. And again, there are things happening at the local level that are setting the stage toward abolition all across the country. Again, it just needs to be done more often, in more areas, and with more support. So the best way to get that support is to continue to educate ourselves and each other, and spend every day living in our communities with an abolitionist mindset. Don't call the cops. You know, like, if someone needs help, figure out a way to get them the help they need. Don't call the police.
Right. I do have to let our listeners in here and let them know that you're conducting this interview, answering these questions so well with 20 cats climbing over you all the time. It's impressive. And we don't need to get into why the cats are there just now. You said a number of things that I thought were important, but I think the takeaway that people need to hear is that random crime is so very rare. You know, you brought it up, where crime happens and when crime happens. And you also mentioned earlier in the interview the fact that stranger killings are actually more often conducted by police in a situation that gets out of hand. So if we're talking about, you know, random people getting killed by people they don't know, where do we need to look on that, right? So
exactly.
The Senate recently passed an amendment to the reconciliation package. It seemed pretty weird, to be honest. Like, Cory Booker was talking about this is a gift, and I think he was being sarcastic, but in the end, I think everybody voted for it in the Senate. And it said that if municipalities or cities decide to defund police, they can restrict funding. So what's your thought here? Is it politicians afraid of police unions? Are they worried about being labeled soft on crime? What's going on?
Yeah, I mean, all of the above. You know, one of the things that is right in the beginning of the 10 demands is getting rid of police unions, because police unions have so much power to influence public policy as well as politicians and how they vote, you know, at every level. And then there are police foundations as well that, you know, taken millions of dollars to further support corrupt police departments. And, you know, the same corporations that earn profits off of prisons, donate to police foundations, and donate to politicians who protect and work with police unions and police foundations. So yes, like, politicians are tied through capitalism to police departments, through police unions and police foundations. So there is certainly the fear of losing funding. But one of the things that, you know, we stand for at 10 Demands is we would never endorse or recommend anyone vote for any politician who's getting any money from carceral punishment. So if you're endorsed by a police union, or you're getting funding from a private security company that's working with the police or something, you're not getting support from us because you are a cop. You're on the wrong side. And yes, the other part of it is this like mainstream media concoction of like this dual, like this dynamic of, you know, crime is skyrocketing, which unto itself is inaccurate. But not only is crime skyrocketing, but the only solution is more police, which is so, is so counterintuitive, because if you're doing something that isn't working and the result is bad, the answer is not to do it more. And that's true of anything. You know, they say like, you know, I forget the phrase, but like, if you do the same thing over and over and get the same result and you keep doing it, you're crazy.
Yeah, the definition of insanity is to do the same thing and expect a different result. Yeah.
Right. And so the crime is, if crime really were going up, it wouldn't all of a sudden go down, because the cities you're pretending crime is skyrocketing, like New York City, which the police themselves put out a report, it is a lie. But if it were true, they have more cops than anybody. They're, you know, the police budget in New York City is bigger than the military budget of most countries. However, we're being told this, we're being fed this. And, you know, alongside this, you know, this stuff like in the liberal area of politics, you know, people who consider themselves to the left of center, but, you know, aren't willing to condemn fascist behaviors and institutions, who are saying, you know, we just need more reforms and defunding the police is absurd and dangerous, but they've done no research into the things I've talked about. They've done no research into what policing is for, how policing manifests itself, and what abolitionists are proposing as alternatives, and what would happen with the money that you're taking from the police departments, or how long it would happen, like the speed of the process. Everything that is being said is a misrepresentation. And so you take all of these things together and you have a bunch of Democrats who are afraid they're not going to get reelected, who want to appear tough on crime, just like Joe Biden did as a Democrat before he created the 1994 crime bill, that essentially created mass incarceration and new Jim Crow. So they just want to, of course, they're going to vote alongside the Republicans so they can say when the elections come, we didn't say defund the police. When in reality, if we just educated voters about what defund the police meant, then people on the left who are running could have that in as part of their platform and actually be elected, because it is the right solution. But as far as I'm concerned, any politician who is going to suggest that there should be, you know, carceral punishment on municipalities who do the right thing would never be on the right side, the correct side to begin with. You know, there are people who have not been elected, who are, you know, running for local government, state government, who are unafraid, who are abolitionist. You know, Kristen Richardson in New York City was just elected to the city council, and she's an abolitionist. So, you know, slowly but surely, we're going to get there. The unfortunate part is that this is a genocide. There are, you know, in addition to the six people cops kill every day, there are all the communities and families destroyed by over-policing, the brutality we witness on camera phones every day on social media, you know, the people who are rotting away in prison, the people in jail, 75% of whom have not been convicted of a crime, who are legally innocent and are there just because of poverty. They can't afford to pay their bail. You know, these people are all suffering. And the longer it takes for us to make these changes, the longer they're going to be suffering. So while I, you know, do believe that they're, that electoral politics are important, because in order for organizations like mine to be, in order for our demands to be leveraged at the local level, organizers need to be able to take these demands to city councils and mayors who are going to actually listen. And so that's why it's really important to not give up on local politics, because if the city council is filled with neoliberals and you know, far right Republicans, we have no chance. But if we have a couple people elected who truly understand what abolition means and aren't afraid to take the risk of separating from the paradigm or the rest of the flock, then we'll be more likely to see more of these changes happening.
Right. And your point about families getting ripped apart is something that I see as a teacher in city schools all the time. Is so many of my students have just a family member who's just gone, right? You know, like, they're just not in their life for their entire upbringing because of the carceral system that we have. Now, the one thing I want you to flesh out before we close is the size of these police budgets, I think, is something that's not known well. So like what we have to work with, right? If we're going to reallocate resources from the police budget and provide, you know, mental health services, addiction treatment, any number of things that could prevent more people being locked away. What is the size of the New York City police budget, for instance?
It's totally insane, honestly. I believe the budget in New York is about $12 billion, $13 billion, something like that. And then, you know, all the other cities are hundreds of millions of dollars. The percentage at which the percentage of the budget that goes to police, varies city by city. In Chicago, it's over 30%. In Washington, D.C., for instance, it's much smaller. But if you look at the sheer numbers and then you compare those numbers to what is invested in, I don't know, infrastructure or housing, or mental health services or any of these things, you see where our priorities lie. Many of our police budgets, this is just local police budgets, are bigger than the war budgets of entire other countries. So, one of the biggest things is shrinking these budgets. Like, that's very clear. That's what defund means. But there's so much more to it also. There are so many groups throughout the country that in the same kind of solidarity of a mutual aid practice have acknowledged that we don't have the time or the faith to rely on the government at all. So while we're pushing for defunding and reallocation, we're also developing our own programs that can run parallel to and in contrast to the state mechanisms of terror. So, you know, there are organizations that, you know, focus on treating gunshot wounds or asthma attacks, helping people now during COVID, people who need childcare. Like, this all kind of would fall under mutual aid, but there are organizations that have different specialties that through community education make their community members aware of alternatives. So when they need help, they don't go to the welfare office. When they are in a crisis, they don't call police. And these are the things that, we need just as much as anything through the traditional state mechanisms, because, you know, convincing a white supremacist capitalist society to kind of work against itself is unfortunately somewhat unlikely. So we can do it at the local level in small ways. We can push for things like the BREATHE Act, as opposed to the George Floyd Act, which, you know, the BREATHE Act provides funding for alternatives to cops and cages, whereas the George Floyd Act gives police $750 million more dollars. So there are things that, we can and should and are doing to change what is happening at the local and state and even federal level. But meanwhile, there's a lot of work being done by abolitionists and, you know, simply humanist community members to create alternatives that exist autonomously and outside of the system, because we can rely on ourselves best.
Right. I like that. Okay. So give us, where can we find your music, and people who want to know more and get involved with 10 Demands, how can they do that?
Yeah, sure. 10 Demands is at 10forjustice.com. It's T-E-N-F-O-R justice.com. You'll see the demands there. You'll see our resource section. There's a page on how this works. It's a bunch of interviews like this that we've done, as well as the video breakdowns of each of the demands. That library is growing, as well as my song, 10 Demands, that was created for the organization and basically puts in music form what abolition is all about, why, like, what our system is like today, and why abolition is the solution. And I think, it, for what it's worth, it's the best song I've ever done.
Nice.
If you want to go to, if you want to check out other songs of mine, you can go to thisisawkward.com. I spell my name A-W-K-W-O-R-D. So awkward with an O. Thisisawkward.com has music, videos, interviews that I've done with other abolitionists, with political figures, with formerly incarcerated people. And on social media, for the most part, it's Awkward Rap, A-W-K-W-O-R-D-R-A-P.
Great. Well, I'll have some of those links in the show notes for this episode as well. I want to thank you for taking the time. You got a lot on your plate, and you got 20 cats in your room. You somehow made it work. It's fantastic.
Thank you, man. I appreciate you. I'm familiar with some of the work that you're doing in Massachusetts, and you know, it's great to have you as a comrade in this fight.
Absolutely.